This episode is part one in a two-part series. This series includes discussion of violence, sexual assault, child abuse, murder, and crime scenes. Some outdated terminology for sex work is used in the context of quotation and legal documentation. Listener discretion is advised. This is The Fall Line. On October 4th, 1978, a telephone lineman was laying cable in a rural area of Lyon County, Iowa. He was out on a stretch of Highway 182 in the northwest corner of the county, not much there, outside of fields and a few houses. A school sat just a few miles away. Ditches ran alongside the highway. Some were 6 feet deep, the Sioux City Journal would later report, and overgrown with weeds. That's probably why no one, not until the lineman came through with his cable, found the body. The tall weeds had obscured her remains. Per the Sioux City Journal, when officials made it to Highway 182, they saw her, quote, the nude body of a young woman who the sheriff's department described as 20 to 30 years old, approximately 5 feet 5 inches tall, with long dark blonde hair and weighing 100 pounds, clad in only light-colored boots. Later reports would describe them as white go-go boots, and her pants and underwear, they were found tangled around one of her legs. According to another Sioux City Journal article, initial tests estimated she'd lain in that ditch for 6 to 8 weeks. But that wasn't for certain, because a later article would mention an approximate postmortem interval of 2 weeks to a month. Out there on the highway, it was a good place to hide a body. Per the journal, quote, even a man who drove a road maintainer past the site once a week, he told the sheriff that he'd never noticed the body. If it hadn't been for the telephone crew's work, she might have remained hidden forever. That had no doubt been the plan of whoever had left her. Those 6 to 8 weeks meant that the identification would be more difficult. Per the journal, the decomposition of the body was advanced. Normally, dental comparisons could have been made, but the decedent's lower jaw was missing, and only two whole upper teeth remained attached to her skull. According to the Sioux City Journal, the Lyon County Sheriff's Office was assisted by the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, who sent a crime unit in to help with the scene examination and recovery, and with a woman's autopsy. Though no cause of death was immediately apparent, her case was treated as a homicide. Her state of dress, her position, face down in a ditch, that made it likely. And details that were later reported by the journal's Dolly Butts, like the fact that the Lyon County Jane Doe was dragged along the ground post-mortem, didn't point to anything but homicide. The autopsy and the testing, though, it would take time, and there were more immediate questions, such as, who was this woman whose body had been recovered on Highway 182? Lyon County officials didn't believe she was a local. Per the 1980 census, the population was just under 13,000, and the sheriff's office would have made short work of identifying someone from their own comparatively small region. Lyon County sits on the edge of the state, adjacent to both Minnesota and South Dakota, and the Lyon County Sheriff's Office is used to dealing with crime that crosses state lines. And the way that the Lyon County Jane Doe was dumped, off a highway, hinted at the possibility that she could have come from out of state. Or, even if she'd been in Iowa at the time of her death, the fact that no one had come forward to report a missing loved one, that made it unlikely she was local. In 1978, H. Craig Vinson was the sheriff of Lyon County. He didn't know it then, but the case of the woman found off Highway 182 would follow him through the remainder of his career in local law enforcement, and follow the sheriffs that came after him, too. Initially, he was hopeful that she could be identified. Per the Des Moines Register, the sheriff's office wasn't short on tips, not in the early weeks of the investigation, In fact, the phones didn't stop ringing. Sheriff Vincent told reporters, "We've been swamped with calls and people coming in looking for missing girls." He said some worried parents had even called him at his home, wondering if the woman found in the ditch could be their missing child. But none of the missing teenagers and women seemed to be a match for the Lyon County Jane Doe. Per the Register, the sheriff's office broadcasted all the details they could on the local news. The woman had been wearing a silver and gold friendship ring. Pictures were disseminated along with details about those white go-go boots. Law enforcement did keep a few details back. At that time, they didn't publicly mention that Jane Doe's feet had been tied together. Not then. They hoped that detail could help them identify the killers. They also saved that rope. The early days of the investigation were met by a flurry of press activity. In October of 1978, it was reported that investigators initially had trouble extracting fingerprints from the Lyon County Jane Doe, but they were hopeful that they would get a set that could be checked against others in the system. Per the Sioux City Journal, her hands had, quote, very nearly mummified. Luckily, though, the medical examiner's office was eventually able to pull a few clear fingerprints for comparison. How exactly they were run by that department in the late 1970s or early 80s isn't detailed in the articles that we read. But we do know that running a fingerprint in the system in 1978, that meant something very different than it does today. Though AFIS, the Automated Fingerprint Identification System, was in existence, it functioned as a combination of manual and computerized comparison, and it wasn't commercially available to all departments until the mid-80s. Per the U.S. Department of Justice, it would be 1999 before a true check in the way we imagine now could really be run. Still, according to the Department of Justice, a comparison could be made in 1978, both against state and federal records. Whether that check was fully manual would depend on location. According to the Sioux City Journal, the details of the crime scene, as we mentioned, the Lyon County Jane Doe's pants and underwear were tangled around one of her legs, suggested sexual assault. But testing, though it was repeated throughout the years, was unable to detect the presence of semen on her underwear. Of course, that does not rule out sexual assault. But that, combined with her state of advanced decomposition and the limitations of testing in 1978, there just wasn't much to go on. Proof of sexual assault could have tied into motive. Unable to determine that, officials still worked to determine cause of death. But in the 1970s, they never landed on a firm conclusion. According to the journal, the medical examiner at the time mentioned, quote, a dislocation of the right elbow and a suggestion of a dislocation of her cervical vertebra, which could have occurred after death. As there's speculation that the Lyon County Jane Doe was dragged to that ditch, the latter isn't necessarily surprising, but the former, that dislocated elbow, much later, an official would tell a Sioux City reporter that it suggested that Jane Doe had, quote, put up a fight. Based on a few factors, it was clear to officials that her death had not occurred at the site where her body was found. The sheriff, who'd noticed Jane Doe's go-go boots, decided to visit go-go bars, dance clubs, basically, in surrounding areas in hopes of finding people who knew her. Law enforcement also spoke with local sex workers. Although it was not by any means a given that Jane Doe was involved in sex work, that was one of the avenues of investigation. But in any case, neither avenue of investigation panned out. No one knew her, or at least admitted to knowing her. Maybe she'd just been passing through. But if so, who had she run into, and why had they killed her? Per the journal, no one had come forward to claim Jane Doe, and she hadn't matched any reports of a missing local. But otherwise, quote, she could have come from any direction. Omaha, Minneapolis, Sioux Falls, anywhere. She might have been passing through Lyon of her own volition, or the person or persons who killed her might have found it wise to dump her body over state lines. And in Lyon County, so close to South Dakota, that was a real possibility. When you pick through decades of newspaper articles, it's clear how much Lyon County did to try and identify the unknown woman who they'd found out on the highway. We've covered a lot of Doe cases and researched dozens more. Often, an unknown person might receive one mention in a newspaper article and a cursory incident report filed by local authorities. The files are thin, sometimes undisturbed for 10 or 20 years. That is, until we request a copy. We haven't even seen this particular file, but we know there's a lot in it, for reasons that will soon become clear. The Lyon County Jane Doe, though, she was covered consistently in the local news, and her case was pursued. Retrospectives came up in the Sioux City Journal, even as sheriffs retired or new ones came into office. The case seemed to be one of the county's constants. In a 1981 article by David Bakke, then Sheriff L.E. Smith shared that they pursued a potential suspect for some time, quote, a drifter who had a record of marrying women, taking them for what they had, and then dumping them. When Bakke asked Smith how many wives the suspect had, Smith replied, your guess is as good as mine. Though the person of interest had been in the area when Jane Doe's body was found, there hadn't been anything solid to connect him to her death. And 3 years after the discovery of her body, Bakke wrote that, quote, officers felt lucky if they got one good tip a year on her case. And then, in 1986, another update came. This article included an interview with former Sheriff Vinson, who'd worked Jane Doe's case until his retirement in 1980. He'd been the one to field the calls from worried parents and taken tips. He'd seen the original crime scene, gotten the autopsy reports, and, apparently, he'd tried to get a forensic reconstruction made so that he could find the right family, if they were looking. He told the Sioux City Journal that, though he'd sent Jane Doe's remains to, quote, either Texas or Oklahoma, the sheriff's office had been unsuccessful in obtaining a forensic reconstruction of what she might have looked like. So there was nothing they could offer besides the physical description that had appeared in article after article. The dark blonde hair, a slight build, 20 to 30 years old, wearing go-go boots, and a friendship ring. Eventually, Lyon County buried Jane Doe in a local cemetery with a small marker that indicated she was the unknown girl. The Sioux City Journal interviewed a man that they called her only visitor. It was the cemetery's caretaker. He told the reporter that he didn't like seeing her grave sit silent while others filled up with mourners' flowers. So he made sure to visit her and to bring her some too, so she wouldn't be alone. The case of the Lyon County Jane Doe passed from one generation of law enforcement to the next. We spoke with Jerry Berkey, a former Lyon County deputy who was on the force for decades. He made it clear how the unsolved murder and the unidentified person's case, intertwined, remained a constant in his department.
When I joined the sheriff's office in 1991, I was aware of the case. Lyon County is a county of 11,000 people in northwest Iowa, we don't have a lot of homicides. And to have an unsolved homicide like that, I think everybody around was aware that it had happened. And there wasn't a lot of paperwork to go through to read up on the case. And I just made myself aware of what was going on. I wasn't actually assigned to work the case until I was made detective, I believe, in 2000. 2002, somewhere in there. And at that time, the sheriff told me to do what I could. And Dan Mosier with the Iowa DCI was assigned to the case. So Dan and I got together a few times and discussed it, and it went from there.
So when you started working the case, did you have any initial guesses as to her identity? Had you been looking at any particular missing persons cases?
I spent a lot of time on the National Missing Persons Clearinghouse website, trying to rule people in, rule people out. Now, she was never reported missing. So that, you know, we would have never found her that way.
One of Jerry's first concerns after he was assigned to the Lyon County Jane Doe's case was to visit the scene of the crime, out in the rural stretch of road on Highway 182. Of course, it had been more than 20 years. Things had changed. But just the same, he had to try and rebuild how things would have been and see what he could make of the information and add it to what others had gathered before him.
In the western part of Lyon County, it's fairly hilly there, tall grass. There is a county park a mile north of where her body was found. But in 2000, 2002, when I would have been there, it was hard to imagine or even know if that park was actually there in 1978. So it took a lot of background research to determine which houses were even there at that time in 78. There was some houses that used to be there that were no longer there. They were just fields. So it's still very rural, but I think it was even more rural back in 1978.
I think that's probably a part of cold case research people don't think about that often, that not only are you tackling a cold case, but you're having to sort of go back in time in a lot of ways and try to imagine the world as it was then, not as it is now. Were there houses, you know, then that there aren't now? Because then you have to track down the people that were in those houses. I just think that's kind of interesting and not something people think about a lot.
Yeah, and Agent John Mueller with the FBI agreed to help with this case back in 2006. And that's one of the first things we did. And we spent a lot of time on doing a neighborhood canvas, which meant we had to put the houses back in place in 1978 and determine who lived where and try to reach out to all those people. We spent a good part of a year probably putting together a neighborhood canvas of residents from 1978. And that was kind of an uphill task to begin with. But we were able to locate most of the people if they were still alive.
So the work went on. And as for forensic art, it came eventually too. Sheriff Vinson may have been unsuccessful in commissioning a reconstruction of the Lyon County Jane Doe, but one was eventually completed. According to the Sioux City Journal, that came in 1998, during Kevin Hammer's time as sheriff. He worked with a publication editor named Vicki Hartigan at Mid-State's Organized Crime Information Center. She'd taken a class in forensic art, but was not a professional forensic artist. The Lyon County reconstruction was only her second attempt at a reconstruction. Still, she offered to help. The photograph of her work came in a later article, where a 3D bust showed dark blonde hair, a thin, sharp face, high cheekbones, deep-set eyes. Later, when the victim was identified, there would be a clear resemblance between the Jane Doe sculpture and the victim's photo. Hartigan may not have been a professional artist, but her reconstruction had been striking. But in the end, all that hard work, the canvases, the art, the databases, none of that would ultimately lead investigators to Jane Doe's identity. It wouldn't be a tip, or luck, or a confession. In 2006, 28 years after her murder, the missing piece would fall into place. Someone from the sheriff's office decided to run Jane Doe's fingerprints through the modern, fully computerized system, and they got a hit in the federal database. The Lyon County Jane Doe had been arrested in California and fingerprinted then. So who was the Lyon County Jane Doe? Back in 2006, the sheriff's office only received the barest of details. Her name was Wilma June Nissen. She was from California, where she'd been arrested for solicitation. She was 23 when she died. When we first read about this case, it seemed as though there were some new fingerprint records that hadn't made their way into a database. So they wouldn't have been available to be checked against the unknown victim in 1978. But retired Chief Deputy Jerry Berkey explained to us that the situation was a bit more complicated than that.
Lyon County is the northwest corner of the state in Iowa. We're a long ways from Des Moines, which is the lab. In 1978, and like I said, I was 10 at the time, so I don't know how things worked. But in 1978, they ran her fingerprints through Iowa's database. Now, when my career started in 1991, and especially when I became detective in 2000, a lot of our crimes, the northwest corner of Iowa, Lyon County, we border Minnesota and South Dakota. You know, our county seat is 5 miles from Minnesota. It's 15 miles from South Dakota. Sioux Falls is our bordering county. We never sent any fingerprints to the lab without asking for them to be run through the federal database because a lot of our criminals cross state lines. For some reason, in 1978, they only ran those fingerprints through Iowa's database. I believe the sheriff and every officer that worked or looked at this case afterwards assumed that them fingerprints have been run nationwide. And in 2006, Dan Moser with the DCI decided he wanted them fingerprints ran nationwide again, assuming they'd been ran once before. When they ran the fingerprints nationwide, they come up with a hit from the arrest records in California. In fact, I think there was more than one hit for Wilma because she'd been arrested a couple different times out there. So the problem was, I think the officers after 78 assumed the prints had been run nationwide, and for some reason the lab didn't do it in 1978. If they would have, she would have been identified in probably early 1979. No.
They'd been there. That must have been particularly difficult for the sheriff who'd worked so hard on the case in the 70s.
Oh, I know. And even the sheriff after him, the one that hired me in 1991, you know, I think he himself was just, what? You know, how could that happen? And the case, if they would have identified her in 1979, who knows? It could have been solved.
Because it would have been so much fresher.
It would have been so much fresher. People would have been alive that we were trying to find that were dead.
So in 2006, investigators began decades behind where they'd hoped to be, a murder investigation gone 28 years cold. They needed to learn about Wilma June Nissen. They knew she was from the West, but had traveled for most of her adulthood, the little that she'd experienced. And as investigators would eventually learn, her life had been almost unimaginably hard. There were things so awful that they seemed difficult to believe, but they'd happened. There were years of foster care records and paper trails to prove that. There had been some stability in her adolescence, and then things got hard again. The person or people who killed Wilma, they might not have known about that hard life. Whoever left her in that ditch along the highway, they might not have known that she was a mother. Of course, even if they had, there's a chance they wouldn't have cared. After all, Wilma's death hadn't been any kind of accident. And her killer, or killers, they'd planned on her body lying undisturbed in that rural land for a long time, likely forever. But secrets have a way of drifting out, and with the revelation of Wilma's identity, more came to the surface. When Lyon County publicized her identity via local papers, the story was picked up nationally. And when we interviewed retired Chief Deputy Jerry Berkey for the series, he told us they received calls from all over, from people who knew Wilma in life, who were able to fill in many of the blanks of who she'd been and how she'd grown up. And that allowed investigators to begin their own official accumulation of detail, because the who of Wilma June Nissen might lead to the why of her death. One of the most important revelations was that Wilma had a family, children, and a sister. And at least one of her children, Crystal Haas, who prefers to go by Chrissy, had been searching for her mother. Chrissy was born in 1977, a year before Wilma died. Though she'd been looking, she had no idea how to find her mother, and certainly no clue that Wilma had ended up in Iowa. What she knew about her biological mother's past and her own history, it wasn't much. She was adopted and raised by an elderly couple, the Haases, before becoming a ward of the state. The Haases, they'd been one of Wilma's foster families too, once upon a time. In fact, they'd been her final foster placement. For years, all Christy knew was that her mother had given birth to her and soon after had left her with the Hosses to raise. She didn't know much about her father or why her mother left. Christy also didn't know that she had two older siblings. Without a fixed address, Wilma had her first two children on the road. They were removed from her custody by social services. But Christy didn't know any of that growing up. She was just told that her mother didn't want her. She imagined a woman who had gone out into the world, seeking something else. In fact, most of what she did know could be summed up in her mother's name, Wilma June Nissen. That's all the information Christy had. That is, until the day the Lyon County Jane Doe was identified. Then, Christy's whole world changed. To tell Wilma's story in order is to tell Christy's out of order. But that's something that Christy's taken on. In the last 15 years, she's assumed responsibility for her biological mother's memory and her case. Because Christy is determined that Wilma's murder be solved. She's gotten to know her in death as she didn't know her in life. When Christy was 25 years old, she was photographed at her mother's grave. Christy, dressed in all black with brightly colored hair and tattoos, might well have stood out in small-town Lyon County. But she's always told reporters, and she told us too, that she's been treated very well there by the media and by law enforcement. And with their help, piece by piece, she's worked to puzzle her mother's story together. Now, Christy is a repository of information concerning the woman that she doesn't remember. She can tell the story of her mother Wilma's and her aunt Mona's early lives, how they grew up, sisters who were neglected and home insecure, and how it set the tone for the rest of their lives. We spoke to Christy in the early summer of 2021, after she reached out hoping we'd cover Wilma's case. She's proactive that way, running her own subreddit to organize information and speaking to the press and podcasters any chance she gets. Here is what Christy knows about Wilma's early life, and Mona's early life too. She's never met her Aunt Mona. As far as we know, Mona is still living, but for reasons that will become apparent, we didn't think it was appropriate to disturb her.
I think she was born in Southern California, but I'm not sure. There's a whole lot of confusion with her childhood. Her childhood was not your traditional loving family. Her mother left her sister and her. Her mother left when they were very small, and their dad had custody of them. Mona was disabled. They were, I believe by the time she was 8 years old, they were homeless and living in a car. I've heard rumors that she had to scour the streets for food and that Mona got locked in the trunk of the car while the dad was at work. They'd never been to school. By the time she went to her first foster family, she was around 10. She could not read. She could not write. She could not eat with a fork.
Did she start going to school once she made it to their home?
I think so. I know they taught her. She wasn't with them for too long. The foster mother got sick, but they did stay in touch with her. And they do still love her.
Once she left their home, did she bounce to several placements, or was that when she made it to the Haas family?
I know she bounced around. It wasn't just, you know, here's a foster home. Oh, that didn't work. Here's another one. She was a live-in school for a minute. Basically a group home type situation, I think. I can't remember the other foster family that had her for a short time.
Do you think that some of the moving around to the different families was because she had difficulty adjusting to structure, rules?
I can't imagine her not having difficulty with relationships.
Mm-hmm.
But from her first foster family, they told me that she was actually really sweet and really loving and wasn't a problem child like you would expect. She was a sweet girl and she wanted to learn. She wanted family.
How old was she when she made it to them?
She was around 10. I think she was with my adoptive parents, her last foster family, at the 17, 18. And it sounds like she would just kind of meet someone and oh, okay, go off with them. She had a free spirit, or that wanderlust, I guess.
Based on what Chrissy learned, it seems the happiest times of Wilma's life probably occurred in her first foster placement with Marshall and Maxine Holt, who treated her well, but had to give her up when Maxine became unwell. After Wilma was identified, Chrissy was able to form a connection with that couple, the Holts, and they were able to fill in some of the gaps in Wilma's story. The Holts told Chrissy things about Wilma's earlier childhood that gave her a little more insight into her mother's internal world.
Did they tell you any stories about her?
There's one thing they told me, and I think it was Maxine's sister had come over. Maybe she was sick or something, and Wilma went in the yard and picked a rose for her and brought her a rose. Just such a sweet little thing for a kid to do, you know? A 10-year-old that lived that life, that already had been homeless and neglected. And I saw home movies. They did have her Christmas. And she just looked so happy and so excited.
What was it like to watch that?
Bittersweet, I guess. It was really cool to see. It was really, really great to see that she had a family that loved her and that she had a place where she felt love and she felt safe and she was safe. It was heartbreaking because she didn't get to stay there. I mean, if she did, I probably wouldn't exist, but she might still be alive.
Do you know where Mona ended up going?
As far as I know, she was, when they identified Wilma, her sister was still alive and a ward of the court in, I believe, in Orange County. So she was being taken care of by a group home.
Do you know if she's still living today?
I think she is, but I don't know. They had said they didn't want to tell her because she hadn't heard from Wilma in, you know, almost 30 years. Why go, hell yeah, we found her. She's been murdered. Why cause her that unnecessary pain, you know?
Through connections and research, Chrissy was able to determine that her biological grandparents, Wilma's birth parents, both outlived Wilma. She thinks Wilma's father lived at least until the 1990s, and her mother into the 21st century. She's kept that information at a distance.
As far as I know, they were not in her life once they were taken away. Once the mom left and wanted nothing to do with them, from what I've been told. And the dad, once they were taken away, I don't think he tried to be in their life.
It's so sad.
Yeah, it really, it's tragic, her life. It's crazy.
Chrissy's own adoptive parents, who, if you'll recall, raised Wilma during her teen years too, the Hosses, they didn't provide much information. The couple had loved them both, but as far as Chrissy can figure it, their quietness and their advanced age, they were elderly when they took her in as a baby, it made things difficult. They weren't willing to discuss Wilma, and they had not expected to raise a child, Chrissy, in their golden years.
What do you know of your birth story? Did she reach out specifically to the Hosses?
I don't know. They wouldn't tell me anything about her. I found out her name by being a snoopy teenager and going through their drawers and finding my adoption records. I knew I was adopted, but they wouldn't tell me anything about her. So they weren't exactly forthcoming with any information. They just said that my mom didn't want me and I was born and she left the hospital and they never heard from her again.
So how old were you when you found her name?
I was probably around 12-ish. Looked for her in the phone book. Once the internet was a thing, went on to adoption boards. I mean, I have to... Sally Jesse Raphael show looking for her back in the 90s. They were like, we can't find her, sorry. I found a Wilma June Nissen in the phone book, and I was too scared to call. I had a friend of mine call. Wasn't her, obviously, but...
It seems like you have been using all the possible tools you can use from the inception of the internet to try and look for your mother.
Yeah, I've definitely... There's times I look for her harder than others. There were times that a year would go by and I wouldn't look, you know, after so long, you just kind of take a break, I guess. I always figured that she was alive. I never in a million years would have guessed. I mean, it's mind blowing her life, what she went through, and how she, you know, how her life ended. It's insane.
So have you been able to form relationships with people who were her friends in California before she made her way out
No.
of state? No.
No.
Mm-mm.
She, I don't think she had a whole lot of friends. And by the time she got out of the foster system, it sounds like she got with her first husband, and it's believed that he got her into prostitution. If that's what it was, he probably was controlling her, and she wasn't allowed to have friends. If he was basically acting as a pimp, he was going to control what she was doing, who she was talking to, and every other aspect of her life.
And at that point, do you know if she was in contact with any of her foster families?
She stayed in contact. Well, I know she stayed in contact with the Hawses until I was born. I don't know how much she stayed in contact. And I believe she stayed in contact with the Holtys as well, because they all knew each other.
So that sort of brings us to that time in your life. How did you become aware that her name had popped up somewhere?
And they ran in the Long Beach Press Telegram that this Jane Doe had been identified, and an ex-boyfriend, friend of mine, childhood friend of mine's mother, who'd actually found my biological father as well, showed up at my door wanting to know my mom's name, and like, I found her.
So when her friend's mother showed up at her door, Chrissy realized that she would have to get in contact with the Lyon County Sheriff. They were seeking information on Wilma, and there would be things, information, forensic material, that only Chrissy could give them.
My husband and I, we just met at that point. I have a little bit of social anxiety, so I can't remember if it was him that I had call or the friend's mom that I had call Lyon County and let them know that that was my mom. But we got in contact with them, and they had me go down to the police station and put my DNA in to make sure. And it came back real quick that, yeah, it was her.
Soon after, Tess proved the relationship, and Chrissy met with the two primary investigators on the case at that time, Sheriff Blythe Blumendahl and Chief Deputy Jerry Berkey.
Blythe Blumendahl, yes. He's an amazing man. He's retired now, but he put so much love and so much work. And I mean, he really went above and beyond trying to solve her case.
What was his reception of you when he finally spoke to you?
He told me as much as he could, especially considering he didn't know me at all. They were really respectful and really good to Wilma. They were good to me because they were good to her. That make any sense? It was another one of those bittersweet things. It was so good to see that people cared about her. It just really sucks that she didn't know it. You know, she didn't, she had to be dead before people loved her, it seems like, you know.
If you have any information in the unsolved murder of Wilma June Nissen, please call the Lyon County Sheriff Department's Detective Amy Stoner at 712-472-8326 or send an email to amy.stoner@lyoncountyia.com. There is a $10,000 reward in this case. You can also visit Chrissy's Reddit forum at r/WilmaJuneNissen for updates on her case. Next time on The Fall Line, the identification of Wilma June Nissen wasn't the end of the story. Not for Lyon County, not for the case, and most of all, not for Chrissy. Now that they knew who Wilma was, there was renewed energy and manpower and funding put toward finding her killer. Not everyone was happy about all the resources that went toward solving the case of a woman who hadn't even lived in the town, but plenty were determined to try everything. First and foremost, exhumation and DNA extraction to try and catch her killer or killers. If you know of a case that should be covered on The Fall Line, there's a link to our case submission form in the show notes. Thank you for listening. The Fall Line is a fully independent show, and we appreciate listener support. It allows us to do research, obtain FOIA, pay our content advisors, and support and donate to the causes we care about. If you try out the products we advertise, please use our sponsor codes. It really helps. And if you'd like to support the show and the stories we cover, join us on Patreon. We're raising money on Patreon to continue to pay for the Millbrook Twins billboard in Augusta and to fund a therapy fund for families who've been on the show. Each and every one of our patrons helps us to continue this work, and we're so grateful for your help. On Patreon, you can get early release, ad-free versions of our regular episodes, plus vlogs and videos for only $5 a month. We've also added video live streams, which all patrons can enjoy starting at just $1. The Fall Line is written, hosted, and researched by Laura Norton, with additional research by Brian Waters, Kim Fritz, and Kiana Burgess. Interviews by Brooke Cargrove, produced, engineered, and scored by Maura Curry. Content advisement by Brandy C.P. Williams, Liv Fallon, and Vic Kennedy. And, as always, our most special thanks to Angie Dodd. Currently, our monthly donation is going to private investigations for the missing. Please join us in supporting this nonprofit. They need funds to help families access the service of private investigators.